making sure that people still have the ability to share their authentic voice with others who will appreciate that. That is what this is about in the end. It's not the technology, it's not even the story. It's that fundamental freedom to really express yourself on a global scale. And that's the thing that I think drives me and Carrie, because it's a set of values around that are really, it's almost like a human right. And so that to me is a big deal.
So welcome to How Do You Like It So Far, a podcast about popular culture and our changing world. My name is Colin McClay.
And I'm Henry Jenkins.
Who's literally phoning it in this week. We're thrilled to have you with us and thrilled to have Carrie Hoffman and John Barth from PRX, also known as the Public Radio Exchange, in the studio. They have been pioneers over the last 20 years in both connecting independent producers with public media and increasingly cultivating independent voices and helping them to find audiences outside of radio via podcasts and on-demand audio. So they've just seen over the last almost 20 years now remarkable growth and change and dynamism in this space of on-demand audio. So we're honored and thrilled to have them in the studio today as part of this ongoing conversation that we've been having about podcasting.
I'm thrilled to be here. It's great. It's so exciting. Marketplace was part of USC, and we were right across the 110 in an area that does not look like the USC campus. So I feel like I'm back home. So it's really nice.
Well, I continue to think. I bump into people from Marketplace every so often, and I like always say thank you, because I'm convinced that the Annenberg name, or the USC Annenberg name, is what it is substantially because of its placement on that show, with which it has zero relationship.
You can thank me. Yes, go ahead.
Now, whoever negotiated that, it's amazing.
It's a great deal.
And of course, you know, to be attached to an amazing show is quite a...
It's good. It's all good.
So podcasting, discuss. So you've been at this, at this public radio thing, as we just heard, for a little while now, despite your relative youth and vigor. it seems like just yesterday.
Just yesterday, yes.
But you have been around the block, even in your now 17 almost years at Public Radio Exchange, PRX.
Right.
We were just talking about your title change from the early days when you managed relationships with stations.
Yes.
And how you work with stations to where we are now when you're thinking about shows and how you improve them. So that is as a meta level, but let's just go back to how you got into this thing.
Into
PRX? Where we came from and kind of like trend towards where we are now.
Well, I worked on an editorial project for American Public Media called Whose Democracy Is It? And we actually were a collaborative project involving 78 stations, the BBC, PBS, Microsoft, a few websites, the CBC, and we needed a way to distribute all the audio that we were doing. And there was only one company that we could go to, and it was a new company called PRX. And I still remember meeting with Jake Shapiro, then the CEO, in a hotel room in the Southwest. And we walked into the room, and he and his CTO began explaining how it worked. And I had no idea what they were talking about. I'd spent a lot of years in the internet, and it's still really baffling to me. Got into an elevator with a colleague, and I said, "Do you understand what the hell he was talking about?" And the guy said, "No." But he says, "We don't have any other choice." And so we became the first client for PRX. And at the end of the project, I called Jake and I said, "This is kind of a remarkable experience, because in the early days of the internet, there was so much vaporware, most of the stuff never really worked right." And I said, "This is the first internet related thing I've been associated with where it did exactly what it was supposed to. Never went down. It worked. It was simple. You guys supported it." And then within 6 months, he'd hired me. So talk about a happy customer. I then became part of the company. So it was wild.
And so at that time, PRX was oriented around solving this particular problem.
Solving multiple problems. So, the key one was finding a way to make it easier for anyone in the world to distribute audio. That was kind of revolutionary. So you could sit in South Africa, you could upload an audio file, and any station in the United States could download a broadcast quality audio file. That was kind of remarkable. So you definitely had to have, audio converters and a lot of things that happened behind the scenes. The second one is that we wanted to solve a real endemic problem for most independent producers, which was pay. So the coin of the realm for most independent producers in public radio for the first 30 years was free. I don't make money.
What a deal, right?
I don't make money, but I get that real good feeling when my piece is up on NPR. And that was the transaction. So we wanted to change that. And so we actually had to build a transaction engine and actually a whole economy based around our business so that all producers owned their own work. They set their own fee based on a certain scale we established. And they were guaranteed some level of income. Now, nobody was making a lot of money, but it actually began sending a message that said there's a baseline of quality. The producers have some range on saying what that is. And the ones who can produce well and understand the market, they're going to do well. Now, some of the producers in the early years were making a whopping probably $2,000 or $5,000 a year based on this, but that had never happened before. And then the third thing was the openness of the site itself, so that anyone who used the site could see every story that was being uploaded and everyone that was being licensed. And the amount of open metrics was also something that had not happened. Working on public radio, most of the data is private because it's competitive. So you don't know how your shows are doing. You don't know how other networks are. You have no idea. This actually broke that open. So on so many levels, this was an opportunity engine. It was a new payment mechanism, a new metrics mechanism, and it really put listeners on the same level as the producers and the buyers. It was pretty great. So it still exists.
So in those ways, I mean, that strikes me as those were inclinations, commitments, problems that you were trying to solve that look to right now, right? Like those value, right. Those things have lasted. At that time, they were really oriented around solving that problem within the public media universe.
Yes,
right?
The public.
It was about getting on the radio and getting heard.
Right.
And it was about, you know, solving the you and your former existence, the problem of distribution for you know, in that ways. And so that's where that was kind of a niche, a nerdy approach to solving substantially a technical problem with values around public
that.
Media, but that's kind of the beginning, right?
Yeah.
And from there, things, well, you know, podcasting started to,
what happened at PRX is actually, and I'm a real fan of media history. And so the path of PRX follows actually the growth of many media companies. So they start off in one, they start from one direction. Many of them, including film companies, theaters, they start off actually as a distribution model. They don't actually own the content. But the next stage, and I tracked this once with the history of Warner Brothers, within 5 years of Warner Brothers, they began moving into content creation. Their first star was Rin Tin Tin. Not a human being, but and not an avatar.
The perfect star, probably.
The perfect star, right. Only dog food, and there you go. And there were many Rin Tin Tins. But so I once tracked that with PRX, and PRX, within 5 years after creation, we started moving into content creation as well. And I said, now this is really kind of crazy. And you could actually map the arc of where a media company goes. So you go from distributor of other people's works to the compulsion to create your own material. And then you start moving into another sophisticated area, which is like, what type of material do you want to be a success at? And for PRX, I mean, the first show that we really decided to get behind was creating the Moth Radio Hour. And they had a problem. They wanted to be on public radio, but they were really struggling how to do that. They also wanted to do podcasting. And when I first met with them, I gave them a $5,000 grant to try a pilot. And the pilot, once we turned it into a radio show, was such a hit with stations. I mean, my phone was ringing from stations in New York and San Francisco, and people were saying, our phones are ringing off the hook. The audience loves this. Is there any more? And I said, there isn't any more. But that's when I went to Jake Shapiro and I said, Jake, I think we actually have the chance at our first hit if we can find a way to work with the Moth. And that's how we created that show. And then eventually, of course, that went to both a podcasting compulsion. So you begin to like master another platform. And then that also led to the creation of Reveal, the investigative show that we do. So
atop all the distribution of everything, yes, from This American Life to...
Right. Know. The core business kept going in terms of distribution and the sophisticated services around that. But since I'm in charge of content, I was really fascinated about what we could do with talent, what we could do with new forms, and actually how our initial goal to transform public radio to, as you know, as Kerry Hoffman would say, is that our sense of openness is to open closed systems. It was like, how can we open a closed system around content? Is there another way to think about it? So, for example, when the Moth Radio Hour appeared, I was paying really close attention to the rapid growth of social media conversations, right? And what is The Moth? The Moth is stories from real people on a platform, in this case, a literal platform called a stage. And The Moth sat back. They might have curated and guided some of it, but it was real authentic stories controlled by the storytellers. Well, that is a lot of the conversation that happens on Facebook and Twitter and everything else. So in seeing that movement, I thought this is actually a chance to actually capture this and create that into a radio show that was, by definition, was going to be as authentic as the audience that's listening. And it really worked. It wasn't a new show, but it was a new kind of show. So those are the kind of things that, as a content person, I'm looking for. Where are the trends headed, and is there a role for PRX to making something like that happen? So
the other thing you've done, going back to the Public Radio Talent Quest and right. now to Podcast Garage, is, and you've done personally, is cultivating talent.
Cultivating new talent.
It's trying to find new voices and encourage and guide and help them to find their voices.
Right, right. Do you mind if I quote myself? So, I once said, a brilliant idea, is that talent is the atomic unit of media. And if you can understand what talent needs, you can actually create new forms of media. And so you listen very, very carefully. So Carrie and I, you know, whether it's podcasters or anyone else, we spend a lot of time with individual creators, and you just have to listen. And I have one trick question for any producer I meet. And that question is, are you in this business to make money or to reach more people, to touch lives? And if they say make more money, I actually give them some other context in another area of this universe. That's not our primary goal. But if you want to change the world by changing people and touching people, we can help you do that.
And you might make money.
Right. But I think Henry, it's something that you mentioned before we started, this whole notion of a value set. You know, what are the values? And for me and Carrie, we do believe we belong to a mission-directed organization, which has a public service component, not a capital P, capital S, but exists for another purpose. And we get excited about that, unleashing the voices.
So as you're talking about unleashing the voices, how do you distinguish what makes a good podcast from more traditional forms of radio? What's distinctive about podcasting?
So I have a canned answer to that. If I knew that, Henry, I would not be sitting here in public radio. I mean, it is 3 seconds after the Big Bang. It is a rather chaotic moment in the growth of a whole new medium. So it is a little bit hard to tell, but the audience is beginning to send us some messages. I would say one that Carrie and I talk a lot about is the authentic voice of a host. If you can capture that heart mechanism of why people connect with a podcast, sometimes it isn't the subject as much as it is that person who is behind the mic. Maybe not me. Maybe it's Carrie. but I think that's actually the one sure thing that I think this medium is distinguished for rather than radio itself.
Well, I mean, this is interesting, right? Because of the early successful podcasts, a lot of the producers came out of the public media world, right? And they, you know, had experience as producers or on-air talent or whatever, and then were suddenly unshackled from those constraints. And in my conversations with many of them, the unshackling took a while, right?
Yes.
Like the attention to clock lasted a long time right. beyond when the clock didn't really matter.
Or objectivity.
Right. And so the coming, what I would say, coming back to center, to kind of finding, to maintaining those public media values, the positive values, without the constraints of that, of the particular way they were implemented in our systems, in right. NPR or the stations or whatever, and finding your voice, that seemed for many of them a complicated equation and led to initially perhaps somewhat less innovation, right? And it feels like now people are starting to spread their wings more. I mean, Henry has been talking a lot about scripted and narrative storytelling and different kinds of on-demand audio that are arising now as there's more space.
Right. Well, right? I mean, so many people in public radio actually gag themselves, right?
Yeah.
And some of that is the culture they've been trained in. Some of that is practice. Some of it is the modeling that they've seen. But you work with so many people in public radio who off mic, they're like amazing. And then they get behind a mic and they sound like Walter Cronkite. And it's like, that's not what podcasting is about. Like you have actually the freedom to be who you are, but tapping into that and actually as unshackling people from their own perceptions of what their quote role is, that's one of the most difficult, most challenging cultural changes.
I think the other-
Hi, Carrie.
Hello. I think the other thing, I've been thinking a lot about this concept of opening up a closed system. So in all of the early days of media, it's been a consolidation strategy. And when you think about podcasting, people ask us all the time, what's the idea? What kind of ideas are you looking for, et cetera? And we always resist answering that question because it isn't our idea. It's the need that the audience has that's satisfied by that particular show, producer, voice, talent, whatever. And when you think about podcasting or digital media around the world, well, if you're in the Middle East, the media that you have access to is from Egypt, basically, and no other choices. So podcasting and audio gives you cracks some light into different and alternatives of media, just like Wikipedia didn't disrupt the Encyclopedia Britannica, and Carta did. And then Wikipedia then took that next step. And so if you believe that access of information and moving information that might be very specific, like this example I gave in today's presentation, sometimes it's a group of parents giving advice to another group of parents in a very, very narrow way. But those are stories with impact for the people who are receiving them. And so if you think about stories with impact, that can be a big audience, that can be a small audience, it can be a specific audience, it can be entertainment, like Serial and Criminal and 99% Invisible, to have a broad audience. When we made Ear Hustle, we wondered in the beginning if the audience was going to be specifically recently incarcerated people. And so the questions we asked ourselves is, well, how much of an orientation do we need to give people around some of the names and of things inside of a prison, some of the shorthand, et cetera. And we learned very quickly that that wasn't our audience and that our audience was much broader. It was people who were affected by the criminal justice system, of which there are 77 million. So it's a big conversation to be had. But for us, choosing whether Ear Hustle was worthwhile to invest in or not has to do with, are these stories with impact for a very particular group? And the answer to that is yes.
And one of the best parts about it is that it's an authentic voice. I was talking with somebody this week who said, if you'd send a reporter in, you'd never actually not only not get the story.
You're reporting on.
Outside in. Podcasting permits you to actually be the person who is living it every day and getting that experience out. And this is in some ways the limitation of traditional forms, but not just of broadcast or audio. It's actually some of the limitations of what journalism is. And so this is a legitimate form of authentic and many times accurate storytelling that otherwise you would never hear.
Well, I think there's an important part of the story that doesn't go through public radio, but goes through more amateur radio production, right? So some of the first podcasts that I was aware of were fan podcasts coming out of the Harry Potter community, where some high school kids would sit down and record something and might get a massive audience. And knowing the history of fandom, fans were involved with radio going back to ham radio and Hugo Gernsback's advocacy for amateur radio in the 20s. And they would have been part of the people's radio movements and student radio movements of the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. So that's a trajectory that would have put a strong emphasis on the authentic voice and the non-professional, non-objective tradition of public media or journalism. And I'm always intrigued, how do those two worlds come together and shape what we think of today as podcasting? And it's not just fans, there's any number of communities experimenting in that way.
I think if you go back one step, one of the things that we talk about a lot is what defines public media. You just defined it in terms of actually very similar to what John did, which is a little bit precious, a little more journalistic in nature. The way that we approach public media is really media in the public interest. So thinking about it more expansively, not defined by the nonprofit organizations, so the non-commercial aspects of it that are more academic in nature. But shows like Ear Hustle, that's actually in the public interest, and shows like 99% Invisible. And we didn't sit around a table and think, you know what we need is a podcast from San Quentin Prison. We had to be open enough to recognize the amateurs and their ability to have an authentic story to tell in the way that they wanted to tell it, and then we could kind of give it lift. So if you think about it more expansively, I think it really matches people at all levels of that success chain.
But the other thing with Ear Hustle is it isn't just one guy's voice.
It's many.
I mean, behind the scenes, there is a tremendous amount of work that is actually in some ways grounded in journalism or professional storytelling, which is, editing, shaping, thinking about narrative, is this really a story? Is this the really one that you want to tell? Is this really it, Erlan? So it takes a team of people who are combining both the, I guess, the amateur authenticity of experience with the real craft that's necessary to really make us into something that over time you really want to listen to, right?
It's true. You know, our whole organization, you know, we work with so many shows and we have them at every level. We have people who walk in the door, have never made something. We have people who, like Ear Hustle, where they need a lot of professional support around them, and, you know, all the way up to Ira Glass.
Who also needs a lot of professional, I mean, look at his team.
He's got a team. Right?
I mean, it's hugely labor intensive. It's well thought out to the nth degree.
I want to pick up on kind of Henry's invocation of, let's say, history, thinking back to the history of radio or early internet, when these were emerging technologies that we felt like were going to be game changers, not in a financial sense, but in a human sense, mm-hmm. and that they were going to allow
access.
People to connect. Yeah. Instead of one to many, they were many to many. They were us connecting with each other. They were hearing different voices and different stories, and it was going to, you know, sort of break the logjam and open stuff up, right, in the way that you've described. So I would argue that radio, television, internet, these things, you know, and there are books, you know, there's Tim Wu has written eloquently on this, and Susan Crawford and others, of this sort of cycle of, wow, opportunity, then, you know, regulation and power and economics and all these things kind of then combining to strip out, in many instances, the things that we love most and that potential, that lofty potential, and not only find that we didn't achieve those goals, but in fact, we took a step back, right? We lost control, we ceded power, and we have less voice in some sense. So now it feels like we're, you know, we've had this remarkable growth in podcasting, and as we were talking earlier, kind of dating from, you know, one example, first podcasts are arguably in about 2003 to Ira Glass on Jimmy Fallon's show with the video of his neighbor saying, this is was she on the dark side of 80? Is that what she says?
Yeah,
I'm on the dark, you know, how old are you? I'm on the dark side of 80. This is how you do a podcast. Okay, so there's an 80-year-old plus woman teaching America how to podcast. Okay, in 2014. So we're clearly there then, we thought, and now we're even closer, right? We have a room full of people who all want to make, certainly are consuming podcasts. So there's a moment. And we have interest by Hollywood and interest by all these other folks in books and movies and TV shows and stardom coming from this new medium, which is really exciting. Those voices are being heard and also represents risk and challenge and entry. You know, Carrie showed a remarkable graphic of, you know, a handful of logos going to a whole universe of organizations that are now involved in this on-demand audio ecosystem. So I guess the question is, where are we now? Where are we going? And what does it look like to try to retain or achieve some of those lofty goals that we set out for ourselves?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, to go back to, you know, Tim Wu and some sense of media history, in a digital world, first of all, speed. So what's happening in podcasting seems to be moving very fast, right? It isn't like radio. So whatever changes are happening are moving very quickly through the ecosystem. And the other one is that we're seeing consolidations of power around producers, distributors that tend toward monopolistic control, right? And so will the excitement that created the medium be able to counterweight that? It's kind of like, you know, the empire is now striking back against this great thing that bubbled up because of the availability of technology. And so, you know, what will be the power of a commercial compulsions because we have to go to sustainability, but is our sponsors going to be driving the direction of this next medium? Is Hollywood or a handful of distributors who intend to sell derivative works? And I actually think it's imperative on the part of us who are on the more creative side to actually grab the stick and make sure that you don't lose that through line of how we got here. Otherwise, I think we just run at risk of, you know, it's just going to be another cable channel in the end. And that's not why we started this.
I mean, and I feel like Radiotopia is, in a, you know, sort of in some sense, I don't know if it's a response or predates some of those big, the more commercial podcast networks that have a very different kind of approach, where Radiotopia is an attempt at elevating those voices and helping them to retain both their independence, but to do it in a way that sort of scales in terms of quality and listeners and is sustainable.
Well, it's
in
a grand sense.
It's a collective, yeah. As opposed to someone who owns a bunch of shows that is creating a network in much, you know, the older studio or like model, right? So that's one way that you're
we're not trying to live this out. Must see Thursdays. We're not doing that. Not yet. I think a couple of just reflections on this. I mean, one of the things that is important to us as an organization is how we actually maintain our independence as in partnership with the independence that we represent. So what's the space that we carve out? And one of those is by having things like a podcast garage. So we carve out a path that says, if you want to get into this, you don't know where to start, here's a place. And we'll do online videos and online classes. But here's, if you live in certain cities, you know, here's a place where you can come in and someone can help you get started or experiment. May not be for you, may be for you, but there's one thing. The second is because we build our own technology, that's sort of another way that we say that's a value. We're not building technology for the sake of it. We're building it because we believe that that actually is an access point that keeps some of that consolidation and power influences a bit at bay. So we make it as a content strategy, not a technical strategy. It's like the mortar, not the bricks. I've been thinking a lot about what self-publishing has done to the book industry. And rather, you know, I think that there's some analogies that we all lean to that are more media, but there are other things like self-publishing that might be a little bit more helpful. So not everybody who publishes their own book is getting a phone call from Hollywood, but some are. So what's that, like, what is your path to that? J.K. Rowling is still untouchable, like from every possible platform that she'll ever be on, because she's made great stories that people can imagine other aspects of and other venues. And even the chat casts about the books are, you know, they're huge pieces of media. And then you'll have people like Reese Witherspoon that, like, any rom-com, that book that comes out, she buys the rights to and just soaks those up. So you'll have pockets of that. But that hasn't dampened the independent spirit of many people who want to be publishers, self-publishers. And so if you think about that and you think about what Amazon's, like, you could think of Amazon as in many ways, good and evil, right? That they've reduced the friction so that this is possible. You can get in front of an audience because you're in a big database, or it can be a corrupting force because you can't be the choices that a big publisher may choose, you know, the criteria that they may choose is only the big folks. So I think that there are some other analogies that we can point to that help guide this. And we always say that, you know, you need bigs, you need mediums, and you need smalls, because that's kind of how a healthy ecosystem in its earliest days. Plants need watering in that way. We're doing this project now with Google where we're looking for podcast talent around the world. It's one of the most exciting things about this. There's been a contest for 6 slots in a training session. And we got over 6,000 applications from 103 countries.
That's amazing.
It's so exciting. We don't know what that content's going to sound like. We don't know what form it's going to take, the languages that it could be in. And the idea that many people in those countries have radios in their pocket, what is that going to do? So we're so early in that. And so I get really excited about what are the bright spots around the world where people are looking for alternatives to the dominant media. Podcasting isn't going to necessarily uproot, you know, state-run media, but it is an alternative, and it may be an alternative that young people listen to. It may be something that, you know, people find their niches of content that they wouldn't find other places. So to me, one of the biggest struggles is kind of along those same lines of how do we maintain an open web? It's the same, like, how do we maintain open access to information and content, things like Wikipedia, things like podcasting. We don't want companies to own the specs of that. We want it to keep growing. And so some of those fights are in that kind of vertical.
And so you brought up Tim Wu. And so, you know, in The Master Switch, I mean, I think that was the fear that he was identifying in terms of the digital arc, right? So that you reduce the number of significant digital players to 4, and they actually can decide global access to anything. And that, to me, is one of the bigger concerns that I have as we look at the future of podcasting and consolidation of power around that. And so this battle is in some ways very fundamental, not just to the business we're in, but to the power of the human voice. And not to get too existential about it, but that is actually the battle of the age. And making sure that people still have the ability to share their authentic voice with others who will appreciate that, that is what this is about in the end. It's not the technology, it's not even the story. It's that fundamental freedom to really express yourself on a global scale. And that's the thing that I think drives me and Carrie, because it's a set of values around that are really, it's almost like a human right. And so that to me is a big deal. Not to get too heavy on it.
I mean, I can't help but, kind of thinking of Henry's work in participatory culture and this sort of, that we're not seeking only the thing that's mm-hmm. going to be the J.K. Rawlings, right? And
we find keeping value.
That space. And,
right.
and so I worry, part of me says, okay, well, who's developing for the, in some sense, the long tail? The mm-hmm. platforms and companies and everyone's going to focus on the ones who are going to generate a lot of revenue and are going to develop stuff that either serves or harnesses or otherwise empowers the front end of the curve. And, and if you take that, and then, for instance, the challenges around discoverability for on-demand audio. And I worry, then that long tail, which is already maybe hard to find the voice for a variety of different reasons, becomes not a design, the privileging of those niche communities, which may be niche and not getting heard by a lot of people, but are really important to that community that they engage with, get disappeared, right? Because they're not part of, they're not a sufficiently large economic, perhaps.
Yeah, even to describe that as the long tail is to read them through an economic lens.
Exactly.
Political, cultural connection to a specific hyper-local or subcultural community.
Totally.
That may not want to make money off of this at all and may simply want to be available to people who want to hear them.
Well, we attribute so often media value to size as opposed to simply the value to the listener. And you had asked a question earlier about quality. And I think we all come out of traditions where excellent technical quality is to be appreciated, and that leads to a more sophisticated and interesting and listenable media. But, I think it actually depends, especially with podcasting, what community you're talking to. So something may not need to be perfectly on mic. It could sound a little bit raw and funky. And in that funkiness, it actually might have an authenticity to a community like, that's okay. If you go on YouTube, there's a lot of stuff on there that looks like crap, but people still play the thing a million times because they're laughing their heads off because that was so damn good. So rawness is almost another quality value that I think we're just going to have to upend what we think of as good. Good is more defined by the community that appreciates it.
Well, for a long time, I'm sorry, go ahead, Carrie.
Well, I was going to go back to something that Colin said, which I think is an unknown in podcasting, which is the role that Google will play when they really get into podcasting. There are more Android phones in the world than iPhones. Most of what we know today in podcasting is heavily defined by subscriptions. Apple's in the business of selling more phones. Google's in the business of selling more information. So that is an influence that we have not seen unfold yet. And the likelihood that they'll break up the notion of subscriptions and, make information more accessible in bite-sized parts, episodes over a long series, et cetera, speeches. The transcription service that Google does will make discoverability kind of a non-issue,
totally different, right?
Totally different. And they care about a global listener. So I think that this is, when John says we're, 3 days after the Big Bang, that is what it feels like, because one of the biggest players in the world access to information hasn't actually played the card yet. And so I'm really fascinated by what that could mean.
Yeah, I was going to say in relation to your YouTube comment that for a long time people thought the worst thing you subject someone to was a home movie.
Right? Or slideshow.
A slideshow, right? And in part because home movies were trapped in the home, and what these technologies have done is freed those to now be public media, but publics of various scale. And I think the rawness and amateurness, we're discovering lots of people love that on YouTube, and I think mm-hmm. do love it on their podcast as well.
Right. And the authenticity part is so important, because there's a subtext that comes with that rawness that says this is true. Can I tell a little story about the development of Marketplace right across the... So when we started on Marketplace, one of the things we were obsessed with was audio quality. And so when we were trying to get business stories or economic stories from outside of the United States or Asia, Africa, we would really, really struggle to try to get people on mic and into a really good studios. Really difficult. And one day we sat around in an editorial meeting and said, you know what? This is a ridiculous exercise. We actually want the sound of the broken up phone line because that signals to the audience we are talking to people outside of the United States. And so that's where a diminution in technical quality actually sent a real stronger message of authenticity of what this show was about. Mm-hmm.
And place.
And, yes, and that's how actually we decided to proceed. And we saved a whole lot of money too. So it was good.
And so it's interesting how sometimes those values align.
Yes, right?
You're putting the extra effort in, you're going the extra mile, but that's actually undermining your product ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why Carrie makes me stay at Holiday Inns.
Now you can hear this alive and well on many podcasts, which is a thing I hope they stop doing, which is that when they want to talk to someone who's not in the room, we have to suffer through the phone ringing sound, even though we know it's a podcast. These things are all pre-recorded. Yes. So it's like such a sham. It really drives me kind of
crazy.
Wonder
if they'll answer. Wonder if they'll pick up.
Yeah, and
know we're going back over the tape and inserting the phone ringing right now.
Right, exactly. And nobody uses a phone ring that sounds like it. So it's like I hear it on all big podcasts, and I'm like, ah.
It's that public radio trope. Yeah, that's just too good. That's just good. You know, I also wanted to bring in something. So you talked to Henry about online community. So I don't know if you were a member of The Well.
I was around it, but not in it.
Right. So The Well, you know, was one of these incredible online. You would use a dial up, but you would enter all these like very specific communities, not unlike Reddit. And that then begat communities on CompuServe and then Prodigy and AOL. But it does feel very much like podcasting is somewhat of an extension of communities trying to be of authentic voice to themselves. And it was, I don't know. I mean, I used to spend a lot of time on The Well. So did Jay Allison. I learned a lot of lessons there about conversation and who gets to drive them and the network effect, right? So who could drive a conversation, then suddenly everybody in that group was talking about that one subject. That was pretty amazing to watch.
I mean, The Well is kind of a Velvet Underground-y sort of touchstone.
It was. So I've got more cred now, is that what you're saying?
For an old guy.
So even the arc you just offered of kind of Well, CompuServe, Prodigy, AOL, communities now, to me also connects to Carrie's point about sort of what happens when Google enters. One of the things that lies ahead is technological change, continued technological change, which we all know exactly what's going to happen with that. We have no idea, right? All these new tools are going to happen, new advertising technologies, new measurement capabilities, all these unknowns, which are going to roll out day to day, week to week, constantly at probably increasing pace over the coming months and years. And that's really hard to predict. That another strand is around late capitalism and just the money that's involved behind the advertising, behind purchasing rights, other kinds of ways that people might generate revenue beyond what we conceive of now as like a path to sustainability or profitability. Mm-hmm. And then other social forces and expectations. So there's a lot of unknown. There's nothing but unknown ahead of us.
These are the known unknowns.
Yeah, these are the known, exactly. These are the known unknowns. And then there's all the unknown ones. So how do we even, how do we even think about navigating those really powerful forces and then the really unknown way in which they interact with one another?
Well, and this is a point that John made earlier, and how does journalism in its hardest form actually survive in when the money is sort of pulling things in little bite-sized nuggets? That's a big challenge. I think a lot about the business models of, people point to Netflix all the time and, in the audio space, like we need a Netflix of whatever. And some people, they used to say the YouTube, but I think we actually have that in the open platforms of podcasting. And Netflix isn't exactly the right example either because the industry is so young. There's no switch from like, I'm paying my cable bill that costs $100 and oh, I've just saved $85 because I've bought this Netflix thing, which has most of what I want. There's no equivalent of that in radio. It's free to free. And so what then does that mean? And we were talking earlier about BuzzFeed. So there's this new category of media companies that they can't quite get the scale that the New York Times has in terms of subscriptions and sponsorship and, you know, diversified income. And they can't do the freemium model very well either. So in the middle, every day is an experiment. And so that's why, like, the news of BuzzFeed is this month we just laid off 10% of our workforce. Next month we're hiring a 10% increase in our workforce. And so you know, because it's just spaghetti against the wall. And you know what we're trying to do is say we want stories with impact, and we have to be experimental and open to what the transactions can be. But we also really believe in open access. So like anything that walls off the audience from, you know, that separates the haves from the have-nots, those are really where the money stuff gets very, very difficult. There's no real subsidy that we all can tap into for what we consider to be impactful content. That's not at play here. And so there's money out there for crime podcasts.
Right. Always.
There's less money out there for, you know, podcasts that are investigating Facebook. So that is the range. That's the field that we play in. And, you know, business models haven't changed that much over many, many years. You know, you're either getting support from your user or listener, or you're getting it from a company that wants to have access to your. So those fundamentals haven't changed. But could they? Could we upset that in some way? What are the things in our toolbox that allow us to, like, not diminish the access points? You know, you don't want to take kids' content, like smart kids' content, and say,
behind the firewall.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's just not good for the world. So, and if you, like these other places, like even in the UK and certainly in Kenya and India, there's no economic model. Like, we have an economic model because people have been giving to public radio for a long time. So there's a sense that, like, the listener-supported model can survive. In those countries, it doesn't exist at all. And that could put a dampening on the people who make creative choices, right? So, and I said this morning, you know, nobody's really quitting their job in these places to make a podcast. That's too risky. So I think that some of the economic models are actually going to be defined in other places because the necessity is greater. So,
you know, and Colin, your question about late stage capitalism and all these changes and how do we anticipate and prepare for that? I mean, I think there's a little bit of a presumption of some level that we're in control of something. And I don't think we're in control of very much except the mm-hmm. creative process. Like, we're not in control of Google and what they're going to develop, nor Apple, nor whatever becomes of phone companies and cable. But we do control some level of our own creative process. And I think that, you know, one of the most important skills that I've learned being a PRX is simply the ability to pivot, 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 change, change, change all the time. So the analogy that I would give is if you've ever navigated in a kayak down a rough river, it's not a straight line. You hold on and you paddle like hell. You're going to go in one direction. You're going forward. But your only goal is
to not end up
on the rocks. Don't end up on the rocks. So you are always in motion. You're always trying to figure this thing out. And I think this speaks actually to the death of many legacy structures. The compulsion of typical capitalism and corporations to stay in their lane and have it the way they wanted it, I actually think that's a death knell for them. And we can see this because more and more producers want to control all of their intellectual property and their authentic voice. And when creatives get together and say, you know what, we're not doing that deal. And as a group, hundreds of us are not going to sign with you. That's when the power switch will flip. And I'm pretty optimistic about that's where we're going. It's going to be uncomfortable, but it's going to be a better level of comfort than waiting for others to, like, lock us in for lifetime rights.
I mean, it seems like this is a place where PRX may have, and those independent producers may have an inherent example, because you started small and I don't want to say powerless, but not in the form of hard power and control. And so you didn't have illusions about being able to control that stuff. And so you built those muscles to be able to navigate the white water and to be able to pivot and switch and to also recognize what are the no-fly zones? Like, what are the things that we're not going to do?
Yeah.
Like that open content, right? Like, what are the things that are our core values that we're going to stick with that we may not be able to make a case for in the way that a VC would make a case or whatever, but that we know that these are core values and they're going to create opportunities down the road. Fast forward to now, when that's stuff that companies, I would argue, that big players are desperately trying to learn and understand, but in all likelihood are never going to get there.
Well, you're reminding me, too, that another one of those kind of lines that we're drawing that I think there are a lot of people who share this, which is the privacy line, too. We don't feel like it's the right thing to trade on listeners' privacy for commercial interests. And we don't think you have to. And events over the last 3 years really make that so obvious. But that is also not the trend right now. All the ad tech, et cetera, is like trying to learn as much as you can about a listener because the audience is so fragmented. So the idea is if I can learn a little bit about you and learn a little bit about you, I can sell to, the car that you both want, that kind of thing. And we really believe, and it's part of our leadership in technology, is privacy, we believe, is a competitive advantage and also the right thing to do. Right. So that's another area that it'll be interesting to see what Google does with that. Apple's actually been a great partner in that way. So far.
But that aligns with their business model. It's
totally
much trickier for the Googles or Facebooks of the world, because they're built to sell your data, whereas Apple is, as you said, built to sell you devices. So that's brand aligned.
And they've been a protective keeper so far in the podcast space. And we for all of the kind of narrowness, of what Apple represents in it, they have been they've been really good in that front. There are so many ways that Apple really could have changed podcasting to make it much more commercial, and they have not. They've just done nothing but really made it flourish. And so that's kind of the cross section,
which is great but also scary.
Yes,
right? Like, because I don't think they're going to change on the privacy front, but they could change. I mean,
for on the economic
they
front. Could
just like they have such an influence on the music industry. I mean, there's just so much power in there.
It's true.
There a yet, right? They haven't done it yet. The other one that Carrie touched on is metrics in the service of who or what. So metrics right now, the whole industry is really designed in serving sponsors and commercial media. If you deal with Nielsen, there's the way the data is collected and how it's used, it's all around that. But what are the sets of data that we need, the metrics that actually serve the creator? Yeah. And I think some of where we've got to get to is who controls what's being measured and for what purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not just a privacy one. It's also like in who are we serving?
It's standards.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're serving the creators. And so the metrics have to work to make my work better, whatever that definition of quality is, and not necessarily to first serve the best ad buy. So
That's
right on, brother.
And sister.
Heresy! What are our advertisers going to say? Wait, we don't have any advertisers.
I think that, one of the things that as PRX has gotten bigger, we feel the responsibility of representing the organizations and the people that we work with. We've kind of settled into the values we've really settled into, and it's honed over the years, but this notion that we support stories with impact, maybe not defined by us, but stories with impact, an investment in talent, and what that means is doing educational conversations like we have today, being generous with what we've learned, and holding classes and training sessions, et cetera. And then the third part is, we've been at this for a long time, and what's the leadership that responsibility that we feel in terms of the messages around privacy and technology and openness and standards and metrics. And so that is a place that we're moving into as we really reflect on the collection of all that we've learned.
Well, y'all certainly have about 6 to 8 full-time jobs between the two of you. So, I mean, I just want to thank you for talking to us today and to kind of sharing all this stuff. I don't know if you have any final words.
I think this has been great.
This is a nice
This
studio.
Is the big Yes.
We could use one of these.
We are a little privileged here. But no, I think we've got some of the big picture insights into what's going on that people don't, who listen to podcasts, rarely get a chance to hear.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you pulling back the curtain a little bit and helping us know what you're struggling with.
We're pretty transparent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for your thoughtful questions.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
I'd love it. There's plenty I can tell here.
So I'm literally phoning it in this week from my home in Los Angeles. Because I'm getting ready for the deliberations of the Peabody Awards jury. I've been serving on the awards jury now for my 5th year. And during that time, we've seen a total shift of how we think about radio at the Peabody's. Coming into it, the first year I was on the committee was the year Serial got recognized for its first season, which many of us agree was a landmark event in the status of podcasts in American culture. This year, we have a record number of podcasts. The dominant discussion around radio is now shifted to podcasts, and we're seeing podcasts being produced at all levels, from individuals making podcasts out of their bedrooms to Canadian broadcasting, national public radio, you know, BBC, large-scale institutions, the New York Times doing the Daily. So we're still sorting through how we determine what the best podcasts are going to be. By the time you hear this, the awards deliberations will be in full throttle next week. But we are going to be figuring out and listen up as we announce which podcasts were some of the best of last year.
I mean, I can't help but the John and Carrie, so the reference of like 3 seconds after, or three minutes, after the big boom, it really does feel at once like we're in full throttle, really moving, and it really has just begun. And, you know, as you mentioned, all those different groups who are entering into one form or another of on-demand audio. Even since we've recorded this series, you had the Gimlet sale to Spotify. You had launch of other kinds of networks. So just really rapid change and dynamism in the on-demand audio space. And lots of entrance by corporate folks and kind of branded podcasts. So it just feels like there's this just huge tumult. And sometimes I got scared, as we heard in that conversation. And then I also realized it's just beginning. And I think one of the things that I really like about the Peabody's is the way that the Peabody's pretty much immediately considered podcasts on par with traditional radio, and didn't, you know, need to create a different categorization and a different kind of space for them, but just sort of said, hey, these are stories that matter, and we're going to consider them. And that feels like for a budding industry to be included as opposed to kind of cordoned off in some way seems really powerful, and like a good first step to the creation of the space.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't occur without a certain amount of angst and anxiety behind the scenes. I can describe that process. And there's certainly this question of voice, was the authentic voice, as John and Carrie were talking about it. That conversation really cropped up as we dealt with people from national public radio and commercial radio on the jury, thinking through what the podcast voice was, how the podcast voice was different. What were quality standards for measuring what podcast was trying to do, the kind of intimate relationship it creates with its listeners, the different ways of engaging with this medium. So in some ways, it was important to incorporate it in alongside radio. On the other hand, it was important to establish a set of criteria appropriate for judging podcasts that were not the same ones as institutional commercial radio had been judged by in the past. But not about lowering standards, it's about recognizing they're doing something different and doing so from a different place.
And I would argue, I mean, plus one to all that, I would argue that actually creates more space. I mean, in so many ways, public media or radio, these, you know, as John said, radio is not really changing a lot, right? Things are not moving quickly in these established institutions. And that when you introduce something like podcasting, it's a chance to borrow and to retain some set of the values and norms and practices from the old world, but also to forget and let go of some of that stuff. So to me, that feels like it actually creates a bridge in a way where traditional radio and journalism and so on can actually reconsider some of their practices and maybe even let some go. And I think particularly for me, that conversation about authenticity and everything from kind of production quality to just authenticity of voice, it for me resonates heavily within the world of journalism, where there's this kind of faux impartiality and then all this suspicion and all these different, you know, kind of things that are happening that maybe undermine the impact of journalism. And I feel like podcasting, precisely because of its authenticity, at least, or potential authenticity and reality in many podcasts, demonstrates what it can look like to really connect with your audience and for an audience to understand where the producer is coming from and whether or not they agree. They don't have to read between the lines to kind of triangulate to their position. It's sort of stated and clear. And I feel like there's other spaces that could learn from that.
Yeah, so I was struck listening to the interview again, how often podcasting are described here in political terms, right? Voice is a word we use often in thinking about political speech. John talks about freedom. We talk about democracy. So podcasting has become a social and political movement as much as a cultural one. And a lot of it is about that shift away from objectivity and towards transparency, toward acknowledging our stakes as citizens in the issues we're discussing and representing those citizens from multiple points of view, as was amply illustrated by the episodes we did around the power and pleasures of podcasting, where we were able to put such a diverse group of people on stage, all of whom offer real-time response and engagement with social issues, many of them voices underrepresented in traditional journalism.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the question is, with this sort of, I don't know if it's a tumultuous moment, but the kind of this fast-paced growth and change and evolution of the space and exploration of all kinds of things, from business models to discovery to networks, and the tensions that, you know, that Carrie and John mentioned around opened and closed and open systems and so on, I feel like the question is it to me is analogous to what we saw with, you know, I don't know, with fast food or with Amazon or with so many other spaces, where there was people were kind of taken by convenience and willing to let go of authenticity and individuality and the edges and the interesting, you know, smaller bits, and that the centralization of power, of data, of visibility in many respects, because of, you know, the market dynamics and maybe our laziness, ends up consolidating the focus on far fewer voices, and those other voices, which might be just as impactful, although to fewer people, or infinitely more impactful, but to fewer people, for instance, might get lost. And I feel like the question a bit to us, the producer, but especially to us, the listener, is, and that those relationships, those communities, is how much are we going to value these independent voices, and how are we going to make our appreciation of those voices tangible, whether it's through financial support or other, you know, sort of policy implications or other ways that we can protect and ensure that sort of tremendous diversity and range and authenticity and so on of podcasting continues to be available and is not crushed between, you know, the maws of late capitalism, platform economics and functioning, and other kind of forces that might see this as just a teeny little space to be gobbled up, when we really think it's a space of freedom and empowerment and connection and voice and all these other kind of deeply human priorities.
Yeah, I think we see it when we look at the top 100 podcasts on our phone to decide what new podcasts we want to listen to. We're looking at increasingly four or five brands dominating that space and a very small number from elsewhere. And we have to scroll well below that top 100 in terms of listening figures to start to hear the alternative voices that we're talking about. So what has started as a grassroots media is increasingly enjoying a kind of concentration of production. Granted, a lot of these guys are good people and they have worthy goals and they represent viable alternatives to the dominant media discourse, which not yet, you know, dominated by the studio system, but it is concentrating more and more, and we have to work harder to find where those alternatives are. And I think it's really important to do that work and for listeners to find content below the top 100.
And I think part of it is about stating those values and sharing the values within the podcasting community, both the producing parts and the consuming parts, to say, yes, this, you know, we recognize that, you know, this is the way that certain dynamics push us, but that these are also important values. And we want to have, I mean, I think that, you know, Carrie's point about metrics being really oriented around marketing and selling your ears to others, rather than metrics being around impact, for instance, there's just all these different ways that power and attention is consolidated. And I think we need to make affirmative value statements the same way that we do when we go to a farmer's market or when we look for artisanally produced things. To say that it's not just for the elite, but that everyone should be able to find and identify and engage with that wide range of voices. And I'm not sure how we do that, but I'm very interested in kind of provoking that discussion, which is sort of it could be a policy discussion, could be a social movement angle. There's a bunch of, you know, things in there that I think begin with awareness and saying we need to protect the values, the budding values of this interesting space that we care about.
And I think a lot of that work is done by listeners. And this is a good moment for us to signal how much we appreciate the folks that have stuck with us over the first couple of seasons of How Do You Like It So Far. We're up to about 1,000 listeners per episode now, which is amazing given where we're starting from cold zero. And hopefully we'll continue to grow. Our listenership is scattered all over the planet, which is, I think, one of the exciting things about podcasts, is it's not so localized or nationalized as radio has been in the past. And so we're surprised but pleased to hear that we have more German listeners than American listeners, right? For whatever weird trajectory this thing has spread through reputations and recommendations, that's where we're at. But we would love to hear more from that listenership, right? The title is How Do You Like It So Far? We want to know how you like it so far. Every episode, we're not pimping you to give us comments on the various platforms, but it's helpful to have those comments and to have those recommendations and reviews out there. But we also are happy to receive email and happy to hear through social media what you think of these episodes, because that's how small podcasts start to grow and push beyond the surface, given that we're not at this rate going to be anywhere near that top 100 podcast on my phone.
Not for at least a couple more weeks.
Yeah, I think so. I'd have to say something really outrageous, maybe about the college application process as we do it at USC to get us over the bar.
You mean like if they give us good reviews, we'll get them into USC or something?
Yeah, something like that. Because obviously USC is as desirable at this point as Yale, so we might as well offer the best to our listeners.
Well, yeah. So, and I, you know, it is precisely out of the book of our colleague David Craig, who we'll be interviewing soon, and his work on social media and entertainment, and just how important the dynamics of creators with their communities and how they engage, where that's where the real power is unleashed. So that's something that we're excited to do more of, and so we really want to underscore what Henry said to please, you know, leave reviews on and so on so others can find us, but especially to find ways to engage directly. So sing out and let us know what you want to hear, what you think so far, how do you like it so far, what you've enjoyed, and so on. Well, thank you for phoning it in, Henry. You do it better than anyone else. Great to talk with you.
Likewise.